Hello, my name is Chris Snipes, and you are listening to The Melt. Sometimes it seems that the only way to get to the light is to go through the darkness. Sometimes you learn that the only thing to do with what seems to be an insurmountable abundance of darkness is to be the light. And then by deciding not to be taken down by the darkness, you can instantly transmute it into something else. Knowledge is what you acquire throughout this process. Wisdom is consciously deciding to learn from it in order to transcend it. It's about not being a victim of anyone's circumstances and deciding to play an active role in your perception of what seems to be the darkness. It's when we become complacent and passively accept what we perceive to be some objective reality that we become the victim rather than the participant. The superculture that today's returning guest Jason Horsley speaks of wants us to be spectators, not participators. Materialism tells us that we are nothing outside of matter. Transhumanism wants to confine us to matter. When we think that all that there is matter, we ironically start feeling like we matter less and less. That intention is insignificant. That meaning is anthropomorphizing chaos. Part of what Jason has been exploring during his latest series of books, of which Vice of Kings is the third in a series of four, is how all of these concepts and more map out in the big picture of social engineering. Throughout these books, he moves between the macro and the micro to try and explain the behind-the-scenes machinations that inform our day-to-day existence more than we may suspect. I begin the conversation by asking Jason how the case of Jimmy Savile, perhaps the most prolific sexual predator in recent history, is a prime example of how widespread institutionalized abuse is.
How was it? Well, I guess we don't necessarily know the answer to that, do we? He's tip of the iceberg, such a cliche to start with, but to start on, but I mean, he's a visible. He's a tear. He was a tear in the veil that kept the superculture, that keeps it concealed. And then, so then you look through the tear that is Jimmy Savile and see all these atrocities. And the assumption is that they're associated with Jimmy Savile himself. But if you look more closely, you see that, there's other features you can see through that aperture, and they are the MI5, the royal family, and Margaret Thatcher, the police, various different police forces, the National Health Service, as in the facilitators of Jimmy Savile. So that's number one, isn't it? Is that he could only get away with what he got away with, and inseparable from that, he could only have become Jimmy Savile, this beloved celebrity, with the help, I forgot the BBC in that list, with the help of all these institutions and the people that run them and work at them or for them. So that's number one. The subtler, more difficult question is, how endemic is it? Is it Jimmy Savile? How is it symptomatic? How emblematic? How typical? You know, how much do his behaviors and predations somehow alert us, if we dare to look, to a modus operandi of the culture, of the elite? I'm a bit wary about using the word elite because it narrows it down again. Because But it, I mean, that's that's sort of where I've started, and that is where the focus generally is. You know, are these methodologies and aberrations of the elite that somehow inform the lifestyle of the rich and famous cryptocratic ruling class? The answer seems to be yes, but then my thesis with the superculture is that it goes much deeper than that. It's not just like this hidden faction that are exploiting the rest of us. It's how that's happened and how they've a culture has been created that we have been formed by and become complicit with, and we're also incepted, if you will, or implanted. So I'm looking for a more violent word, actually, because it's penetrated by these values, like hooks in our flesh that we're hanging by, but also we become puppets of it, and therefore we become instruments of it, and we perpetuate the thing. So yeah, the short answer is I think he's extremely. I mean, I'm a bit shocked by my own answer, really, but I think Jimmy Savile is kind of at the face of our culture in some ways, or could be seen as.
For sure, and there's also the aspect of it, too, I think, that is he, you know, were the people around him that allowed his behavior to continue, were they merely participating in complicity by turning a blind eye, or were they also engaging in things like that? Was he a part of a bigger sort of a ring of people that were engaging in the same sort of debauchery that he was?
Well, we know, pretty much we know. I mean, as far as we can know these things, that's a bit of a meta question, but based on what's been disclosed anyway, we know that the latter is certainly the case, that he was procuring children for other elite. He was part of pedophile rings, or work with them in tandem with them. But presumably, inevitably, there would have been also a whole, it's like circles within circles, but at the National Health Service, for example, apparently, allegedly, or more than allegedly, really, but again, as far as we know, based on the testimonials, Jimmy Savile was exploiting, sexually abusing victims of all ages at the various hospitals that he had free access to, many of which he'd helped to build through his charity work. And apparently many of the staff were turning a blind eye, as you put it. Now, presumably that's the spectrum. Presumably, I would presume anyway, that some high-level doctors, male or female, were also, you know, taking advantage of those opportunities, were also exploiting patients, but that others, probably perhaps lower level nurses and so on, might have not been engaged in anything like that, and might have even tried to say something, but quickly found out that it wasn't going anywhere, because in order for action to happen, it has to go up the levels, and somebody has to make, you know, so at a certain point, we see it in the movies, you know, when a low level member of an institution sees corruption, goes to the next level and reports it, and then waits for something to happen, and nothing happens because either that person squashed it or they've gone a level up. At a certain point, they've got to a level where there is knowledge and complicity, deep complicity, and so it, you know, it goes nowhere. So then the person who really is not complicit or doesn't want to be complicit has to make a choice then, really. They stay or they leave, or they cause a stink and probably get fired, or worse.
Well, is there, I mean, you hear about these days when people are trying to out this sort of behavior and these sorts of rings of people that are engaging in it, getting offed, like, you know, Isaac Cappy is one notable and recent example. Were there things like that going on back then too? I mean, were there people that were getting sort of disappeared for, you know, trying to tell people about this?
I think this is Jill Dando comes to mind, but I'm very bad with names and facts and dates. So people should, you know, check that. But there was definitely a reporter for one of the mainstream papers. I don't necessarily want to say tabloid, but probably tabloid or almost tabloid, like the Daily Mail. Anyway, you know, I'm going to bolderize the facts, but yes would be the short answer. I mean, I have heard of at least one case there of a reporter who was writing about that and who died under mysterious circumstances. It's not conclusive, is it? But I mean, it just stands to reason. Obviously, if you're exposing criminal activities, then it's a high risk occupation.
Absolutely. Well, it seems like there's a couple of ways of going about it. You get, the extreme would be you get disappeared. The other extreme would be that you get publicly ridiculed. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, I didn't know if that was more of the MO back then, or it, just like today, people were sort of getting pushed off bridges and the like.
Well, we don't know, do we? Of course,
yeah.
I mean, an effective silencing strategy means we don't know. We might hear about the death, but we don't associate it with foul play or with the activities that person was engaged with, presumably to silence somebody before they've even done any damage. So only the people who had inside information would know there might have been a deeper reason for it. I mean, presumably this stuff is just going on all the time. I mean, we're in an interesting period in history because with the internet, information's become free, in quotes, and it's much easier to reach a lot of people almost instantly with information. I mean, this was one of the reasons that it came out about Jimmy Savile, perhaps even the main reason, although it's possible that there were, you know, hidden reasons, there usually are, was that after he died, people were talking about it on the internet and found each other, and it was sort of a critical mass because they were able to gather together to connect so quickly, and suddenly very quickly it became apparent that there were dozens if not hundreds of these people, and that created a certain amount of momentum. That was after it died, so I would also suspect that there wasn't too much concern about it coming out, although it was still suppressed somewhat, I think, or at least judging on the result, which is that most Americans still haven't heard of Jimmy Savile, even though that is a history. I mean, history was really made it transformed history, really. What came out about Jimmy Savile, and that makes it historical in itself, that we could be so wrong about history. I mean, admit it, it's the history of entertainment, but still, I mean, it's still history.
Yeah, and he had his, for lack of a better term, had his finger in a lot of pies, you know? And now knowing what we know now, he looked like a dodgy character to begin with, but now he strikes me as absolutely insane. I mean, he just looks like a fucking lunatic.
Well, we can say that now. But what about Russell Brand, say? Russell Brand looks like a lunatic, but nobody's going, oh my God, he must be a... not nobody. I'm suspicious of Russell Brand, and not only because he looks like a lunatic, but my point is that kind of extroversion, if it's in the right context, is just seen as eccentric.
Of course, of course. Marty Feldman didn't look necessarily like a sane person either, but... that's neither here nor there, unless there's something about Marty in your new book, which I haven't read yet.
Well, so. No, but as a general, there isn't. But as a general thing, it's the Quentin Crisp maxim: what can't be concealed should be actively displayed. Not misquoting slightly, but and you know, a colourful character. It's certainly a way to wear one's proclivity on one's sleeve. and in a, and to defer suspicion, because particularly we're in a culture where we've been conditioned to believe or to have certain associations about what criminals look like and what they act like. We didn't used to think anyway that they would act like Jimmy Savile. They wouldn't be so brazen. That, you know, they would be shifty and shady and hiding in plain sight kind of thing. And they wouldn't be obviously flamboyant with their apparent perversities, because it seems counterintuitive. Person's up to no good, they try and conceal it. Whereas he was bragging about it and telegraphing the fact that he was a weirdo. But he was a weirdo who was a DJ, who, etc., etc. That was part of his public persona. So it was seen as, understandable. It was seen in a totally different context. So this is an eccentric entertainer, and he's, and people loved him. I mean, that's the main thing not to forget. I mean, Michael Jackson would be a really obvious example now. People to this day are defending Michael Jackson. And those people, of course, be very different from me and perhaps yourself, don't think that there was anything weird about Michael Jackson or anything deeply disturbing about him separate from the allegations, if you know what I mean. I mean, to me, Michael Jackson was very creepy, as soon as he started messing with his skin and all the rest of it, it became more and more obvious that there was something really wrong there. But to the people who defend him and refuse to believe that he might have been committing these acts, they haven't even taken the first step to be able to see that there was something wrong, regardless of what he was doing in his private life. There's clearly something wrong with Michael Jackson, but millions of people can't see that.
Well, a question that I started to ask during the last conversation that we had that was a bit premature was about a very major player in this superculture, and that would be the Fabian Society. Could you educate us? Because I really, before you came along, I had not heard about this at all. So what were they about? Well, I mean, they were supposedly a bunch of progressive liberals, but their agenda was slightly more sinister.
Yeah. I'm not sure if I can educate anyone. I got two angles of approach to the Fabian Society. One was information, and that was John Taylor Gatter, The Underground History of American Education, which I happened to come upon that chapter on the Fabian Society. I presume I was already looking, but anyway, it's just one chapter in a large book, but it's very densely packed with information. So anyone who wants to know quickly about the Fabian Society without going to some, shall I say, right wing, or shall I say, let's say, ideologically leaning websites that are expressing moral outrage about the Fabians, because there's quite a bit of that online, something that's just balanced and fact-based, they can find that book online as a PDF, and the chapter on the Fabian Society got an awful lot in it. My other angle of approach, the original one, was family. You know, that my grandfather was a founding member of the local branch in Hull. And so I'm like, well, who are these guys? Like yourself, I'd heard of them, but it didn't mean much to me. So, so what I did with The Vice of Kings, or what was Occult Yorkshire initially, was I wanted to find out more about the Fabian Society, because of my grandfather's involvement, and I don't want to say an agenda, but I had specific reasons and specific suspicions. So I was looking to either disprove or confirm suspicions, as in where the Fabian Society, where their agenda is compatible or even complicit or even simultaneous with the kind of institutional abuses that I was interested in mapping, and that I also felt I'd been on the edges of in my childhood. So I wasn't trying to discover or map a full history of the Fabian Society and who they were. I was following leads that seemed to be leading into a better understanding of the institutionalized abuse. So then that's why I say I don't really have a very fully rounded view of the Fabian Society. But it's true that one of the areas of intersection is their liberal progressivism. I qualified all that because they weren't only. I mean, the Fabians were also neo-Marxists, perhaps, or certainly the Fellowship of New Life, which became the Fabian Society later, came about in London right when Marx died in London. So, and certainly they were reading the works of Marx, whether Marx himself was directly aware of what they were doing or in any way involved. That there's such an obvious intersection there that it can't be ignored. But certainly socialism anyway, there's socialist principles, which coexisted with these, what we now think of as liberal progressive principles. Specifically, I mean, Havelock Ellis was one of the founding Fabians, and he is the famous sexologist. He's a forerunner of Kinsey, Alfred Kinsey. In certain ways, maybe even more influential, but not so well known. And he seemed to advocate the principle that liberation, social liberation, is inseparable from sexual liberation, which is inseparable from sexual perversion, as in, or rather, the eradication of the idea of sexual perversion, that anything goes, sexually speaking. And so he was one of the pioneers of what we now think of as tolerance, particularly around sexual lifestyle, LGBT, etc. And so he coined the term homosexual. I believe he did some of the very early investigations into pedophilia. So that's one thing. Experimentation with mescaline, and then, which later was Huxley, you know, it's like the whole psychedelic revolution. That can also be traced back to early Fabians, not in the sense that they created the movement, but I mean that they were early adopters of it, if not, you know, early influencers. And that, the key principle of the Fabian Society, for me anyway, is that they were influencers, that their goal was social influence. And that they had a specific set of values that I would say were strategic. And I think, I mean, H.G. Wells wasn't a Fabian, but he was on the periphery of it. Bertrand Russell ditto. I think Bertrand Russell was closer to real affiliation. George Bernard Shaw. And all three of those writers, I'd say, had a leaning towards a scientific outlook, towards creating a scientific-based society, Aldous Huxley and Brave New World being the fictional blueprint of such a society, not the only way it could go, but one example of what it might look like. And so the socialism is consistent with that. Like, how do you create a society that is the most just society by a specific criteria, in terms of everybody's as comfortable as everybody else? That's the idea of a just world, I guess. It's maximum comfort for all, even if that means drugging people and lobotomizing them, say, for example. And just as a last point, the scientifically designed society, which had socialist principles, seems to be geared towards providing the most amount of convenience and comfort to the greatest number of people, but was not interested in freedom. They might have used freedom as a buzzword. I'm not sure offhand. I presume they did, because that's the thing of the wolf in sheep's clothing, the logo, is that their values seem very benign and humanitarian. Maybe they were humanitarian, depends what that word means. But they were disguising another agenda, or at least they were disguising that they were consistent with another agenda, and it might have been divided, and that was more power to the state. So you give more comfort, more luxury, more support to the individual, but only by empowering the state more and more. And that seems consistent with the socialist principle that the individual is a problem, or the individualism itself is a problem, and the collective is what matters. So socialism is collectivism, or it's consistent with the idea of collectivism. What's the greatest good for the greatest number, but somehow the means to that supposed idealist end is the total empowerment of the state and the enslavitude of the individual to the collective, which is to the state. And of course, for a state to run in such a way efficiently, like this scientific engine of benevolence, it has to have a ruling elite to run it. So there's this principle of, it's a hierarchical principle that the intelligent, the properly educated, or the rightly aligned rule, while the rest are ruled. And while the state is supposedly serving the mass, really the mass are slaves to the state. So,
and one of the ways to instill sort of those values, right, is the school system. So that became a kind of a key aspect in the social engineering aspect of the Fabian society, right?
Yeah, that's right. And that was the, well, hence it was in John Taylor Gatto's book about education and American education, no less. It wasn't about British education. So that some of the principles, or maybe all of the principles that the Fabian society as individuals we're trying to permeate society with, successfully infiltrated as a kind of ideology, an uber ideology, really, that infiltrated all these different levels. Economics is another key one with John Maynard Keynes. But education, I think I would agree, is it was the principal one. And hence it, this is one of the ways that it crossed the Atlantic, even though the Fabians weren't directly influential in US society the way they were in British, because they created the Labour Party. Still, their ideas permeated American society, and particularly, obviously, I think, in the education system. And I think we're even seeing the fruit of that, or the rotten fruit of it, what's become of the modern education system. I don't feel very qualified to talk about it because I'm not part of it, but I know it's a big area of controversy now. And the universities have become kind of madhouses in terms of the things they're teaching and how deranging they are and how divorced they are from any kind of practical reality. Identity politics is the obvious, thing we could focus on there, but we might get sidetracked. The main point is that I would say that there was a specific intelligent design behind the subverting of the education process, and that the faith is central in that. Yeah.
Do you think that the professors that graduate from these school systems and they go on to become the quote-unquote experts that the masses look to for further social engineer them? I mean, they sort of become the ambassadors for this agenda. They're sort of the priests.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's a short answer. There's quite a spectrum currently, because there's certainly lots of academic figures who are rebelling. So Brett Weinstein comes to mind, Jordan Peterson's the famous one. Mm-hmm. Now they are instruments of social engineering too now, because they're famous enough to have that much influence. And they're in danger of becoming demagogues, as I think Jordan Peterson already did before he had his meltdown anyway.
Yeah.
But but they are a reaction against something. So it's pretty complicated. I mean, that's why I was a bit unsure about how to talk about this, and because I think the education system was never good, really. I mean, one of the things I just touch on lightly in The Vice of Kings is the way that the Prussian education system was the template for the education system in Britain and the US. Just the basic formula of classes, compartmentalized or, what's the word? I can't think of the word. But anyway, all the subjects being separated out from each other, you know, geography is separate from history, is separate from physics, is, you know, everything gets boxed off like that. But then in time as well, time gets boxed off. You get the 50 minutes, whatever it is in class, and then the bell rings, very Pavlovian, and then everybody shuffles to the next classroom. All of that, it's the medium, is the message. That is indoctrinating people independently of what they're actually learning, quote unquote, being told verbally. Just being herded around like that day after day is a way to regiment a society, because it conditions us from childhood onward into robotic behavior that is obedient, blindly obedient. So the whole system was destructive. Even before there was any kind of ideological, well, I'm sure there always was an ideological slant, but I mean, independently of what it was. So long before the Fabian Society, took over and really started tweaking it, I would say that we'll go back to Sparta, you know, and it's, like education. I'm not sure if there was ever a time where education wasn't somehow traumatizing or trauma-based in some way or another.
Sure, especially like military schools or prep schools where you go away and get, you know, the headmaster either beats you or molests you or both, or, yeah, you're far away from your parents.
And the older students as well. Yeah, well, that's something that isn't talked about enough. And this is, we're back to Jimmy Savile now, and this key area really for me in my recent books, the intersection between this kind of militaristic indoctrination that we're talking about, programming through education and trauma with sexual abuse. So that sexual abuse is consistent with that. It's not some weird perversion that occurs in that environment. It's actually part of the methodology. I mean, he's Michael Jackson as a case study in 16 Maps of Hell. His father sexually and otherwise abused him in order to create Michael Jackson, not just because he was a pervert and a fuck up. there was a method in the madness. He wanted to turn young Michael into a superstar, and he was successful. And so the British schooling system is obviously not so extreme, or at least doesn't create so many celebrities or whatever. I mean, it's more about just creating productive workers, but CEO, high level, if you're talking about the kind of school I went to. But it does use corporal punishment, and the sexual abuse, I think, although it'd be impossible to say, you know, how consciously people are doing this, who are complicit with it, but it is a central part of the trauma training. It's initiation. I mean, it's somewhat conscious. The hazing rituals, for example, you know, kids go and they get hazed and they get buggered and they get beaten, and they're told it's for their own good and it's part of the initiation, and then they do it to the next kids that come along. And so they've got but two things going on. One, they're angry and they're abused and they want to take it out on someone. And two, it's part of the program. They are told that. So it isn't really that secret. That's the weird thing. We kind of, when I start to talk about it, it's like, well, yeah, of course, actually, we do know this. But before I've said it, I'm like, well, but that's just too bizarre. You know, people couldn't possibly believe that, could they? But they do.
Funny how that works. The conditioning obviously has been successful to some degree. So what aspect of the Fabian Society was out to normalize pedophilia? How did that become a part of it?
Well, that was early on. Well, I say it was with Havelock Ellis anyway, because he had this value or this idea, let's say, that for man, human, for the human being to be free, and I can see the reasoning in this, he had to free up his life force and not for it not to be socially constricted. Therefore, sexual perversion or a totally unrestricted experience and expression of sexuality was the key to, and the proof of, a liberated spirit. So I think he, like Crowley or Kinsey as well, many people we could probably name, he made a logical error. Went from saying that, you know, if we were entirely free of shame about our sexuality, then that would free up our life force, to if we, or to the more perverse we can be, the more free we are, which is a Crowleyan kind of, that's the path, the left-hand path of transgression. I don't have any evidence, and find any evidence that Havelock Ellis was practicing that the way Crowley was, or Kinsey for that matter. But nonetheless, you've got that principle there. It's twisted enough as it is. And so then if we flash forward to the 70s, the late 60s was when homosexuality was legalized or decriminalized. And then, of course, in the years, subsequent years, the early 70s, gay rights and sexual, you know, liberation. That was the time that the pedophile information exchange came into form as an offshoot of the Councils for Civil Liberties, National Civil Liberties, I think it was called. And that was based on the same template. I thought, well, if homosexuals can have their freedom, why can't we? But that wasn't specifically a Fabian agenda. It's just that some Fabians were part of that. You know, there was an overlap. And as I said, one can trace the values that were becoming more and more mainstreamized through the beginning, the early days of LGBT, etc., Q, T, whatever. Now, one can see them in the very formative years of the Fabian Society. Another one would be, and that's more, that also seems like it, that this must be a benign one, would be the compassion for the criminal and the placing of all responsibility for criminal behavior on the state, as in criminals are just unhappy, maladjusted people, and therefore they shouldn't be punished, they should be reformed.
They're just sort of victims of their circumstances?
Just victims of the circumstances. So you can see initially that seems a compassionate perspective and even a true one. But again, it gives more power to the state. It's taking away responsibility and freedom of choice from the individual. They're saying you're just a victim of circumstances, right? So it's as though there's a Trojan horse in all of Fabianism, the wolf in sheep's clothing. It looks like it's compassionate, and in a certain sense, it could be. I mean, it can lead to compassionate policies, such as, you know, less draconian punishments and so on. But hidden inside it is something else, which is stripping the individual more and more of his or her individuality.
Mm-hmm. It seems like Wilhelm Reich was playing around sort of with that dynamic of suppressed sexual energy, and the release of that would free an individual up in many other ways. But I don't ever recall, or I've never read about him taking it to any perverse ends. Have you? Do you know much about that?
No, although I think he did advocate to some degree sexualizing children or allowing children. It's a blur, it's a fine line, because allowing children to sexually experiment, right?
With each other, say.
I mean, I'm not referring to specific facts about Reich, because I can't pull them up. But just as a general point, the recognition that, yeah, the life force gets constricted through social repression of our natural being, and that could include sexual, or does include sexual expression, that can very easily lead to, well, we should create space for children to not be ashamed about their sexuality and to freely explore their sexuality, to let's help them explore their sexuality as responsible adults, which clearly, well, that's obviously what pedophiles would love to do. They're going to be lining up to volunteer for that job.
Absolutely. So the pedophile information exchange was more sort of an offshoot of the Fabian Society.
It was an offshoot of an offshoot.
Okay. Gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay, well, what was dandyism and what were the roots of that movement? Would you call it a movement?
It was a movement. I mean, again, you're testing my powers of recall now, because as I told you, I don't remember most of what I put into these books unless it's personally very meaningful to me. My brother was a dandy, so the dandy thing is meaningful to me. I didn't know until I was writing Occult Yorkshire that dandyism went back as a movement. But I can't remember the name of it. It was the Gentleman's Well Dress Club or something like this. And it was
Men's Dress Reform Party.
Thank you.
Yeah.
It came to the rescue there. And that did have a socio-political end. It was to do with, instilling pride and the idea that better dressed men would attract more attractive mates. And so it was eugenics. As part of the eugenics agenda, or at least consistent with, which again is was central to the Fabian perspective and a good example of a scientific approach to improving circumstances. We need to re-engineer the genealogy, the genetics of the human species, just an example, but obviously a very central one. And now that's enough to blacken the Fabian Society, just that they're into eugenics. Although I don't think it's the worst of what they were advocating, but it's very emblematic of it. Coming back to the dandy, though, or do I want to actually? I did. I want.
You don't have to.
Complete answering your question. I'll leave it at that. Cause,
okay. Yeah. Yeah. I have many more questions.
Okay.
Such as, what was the order of all these crazy organizations and affiliations and stuff? I have no idea about any of this stuff. The Order of Woodcraft Chivalry. What on earth was that all about?
It was camping, wasn't it? Again, I love how so many of these examples are, they seem so innocuous and benign. I mean, that was one of the most shocking things to me, was because I was close on the edge of that. Like, Abbotsholme was a school I went to, and we did camping trips on Abbotsholme, and Cecil Reddy founded Abbotsholme School, who was a member of that society that you just mentioned, and the Fabian, I believe. And again, it was about something very benign, which is about, let's get children back to nature, back in touch with nature.
Like Boy Scouts.
Yeah, well, yeah, okay. So, and I was going to say, one can, if one already has a suspicious mind, let's say, or aware mind, one can already see, where this might lead. Children back to nature, that's naked, is much more natural, have children running around naked. It's remarkable how quickly a really benign and healthy and a really good idea somehow intersects with something that's the opposite, right? The other obvious thing, sorry to interrupt, would be, fascism. We know that fascism has a back to nature ethos.
Yes.
And, you know, the kind of training. I mean, one, more than a theory, one thing I observed in Occult Yorkshire was that this order of woodcraft business also intersects with Wicca, as I'm out, was clearly an instrument for the aristocracies to make sure that their legacy, their children, didn't degenerate. Because if you're an aristocrat, are very wealthy, and you have children, they're wealthy too. Well, they're going to get lazy and decadent. They don't have to do anything because it's all provided for them. and then the line, you know, deteriorates. So this kind of toughening up of children through exposing them to natural reality is consistent, back to Sparta again, is consistent with the, you know, the aristocratic or the ruling elite's methodology for training and indoctrinating their own kin or their own children. But, and I think it, I mean, I haven't thought about this really, I'm just thinking about it now, but as it turned out anyway, it's a way to, maybe it's a survival of the fittest thing, it's a way to exploit other people's kids. You know, you can be giving your kids what you know, you think you know that they need, but also you're creating an environment in which you can exploit other kids. And those who don't survive, those who are traumatized by it, well, they're, you know, they're the eggs that go to the omelet, they're the slaves that will serve. So yeah, it's like an artificial selection system.
What I was going to say too is that they're conveniently away from their parents. They're out in a completely different context, ripe for indoctrination. It's kind of sort of a little autonomous zone there. And who, you know, different things are going to happen there than they are going to be in their natural everyday lives around their parents.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and I mean, for many, many hundreds of years, the children were raised by community. And this nuclear family, which the Fabian agenda, as has been talked about left and right, you know, the destruction of the nuclear family, there's countless Christian voices who are decrying that and have been for decades, and they're not wrong. And they'll, you know, they'll point at homosexuality and sexual liberation and drugs and any number of things that once upon a time I thought were good.
Feminism
as tools of that and as symptoms of it. But before the nuclear family, there was a community-based family. So I don't think the defense of the nuclear family is necessarily the right approach either. I think it's missing something too, in that the nuclear family itself was maybe defense against something and a good one. I mean, it was better than the alternative perhaps, but, as in, you know, the state taking over our children, which is, you know, which is what the other side's pushing for, so to speak. But there does seem to be something natural in children being raised by a collective. So it seems as though the nuclear, that was how it was for maybe hundreds of years. And, but then as, you know, post-agriculture and then certainly post-industrial revolution, as, community life became less and less natural and natural, then the nuclear family sort of became more necessary as a protection against the encroaching forces of the state, of industrialization, or even pre-industrialization, you know, kings, I don't know, my history is terrible, but you know, the kind of state power anyway. And what the state is doing then, adopted as a way to try and get the children, was let's simulate this community child raising practice. Let's create a simulation of it. So again, it looks quite good. I mean, for many children now, and when I was growing up, potentially it would be better. It would have been better for me to grow up in a kind of community such as I went to Abbott's home, with lots of other children and camping and being in nature, and not with my crazy alcoholic parents. You know, my nuclear family was radioactive. But I couldn't stay at Abbott's home. I got into too much trouble. And I bet there was the dark stuff going on there. So I think it is more of a Trojan horse, whether or not it starts out that way. This is the thing I could never answer. You know, the road to hell leads to good. I mean, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. The baffling thing about Fabian Society—they had these really good intentions, but they always led to bad ends. And I couldn't fathom whether that was consciously or not. As in, the wolf in sheep's clothing it's not really a sheep. It just knows how to pretend to be one. Or the schizophrenic wolf that thinks it's a sheep.
Yeah, that's a good point.
It really has good intentions, but is unconsciously driven by so much neurotic stuff that it paves the way to hell. And I think it's both. I think it's definitely both. And I suppose it would be. I mean, people are complicated.
Absolutely, absolutely. Not everybody. It's not a hive mind. I read the wolf in sheep's clothing as something rather sinister, and especially when you describe the Fabian Society's agenda as being wanting trying to achieve such a pervasiveness in all aspects of culture and over a long period of time. So they had the big picture in mind.
Yeah. Well, and we have that idea, certainly I do now, that that's something sinister. Well, we all do, because it's in James Bond movies, and you know, I can rule the world. And we're not, it's not wrong. I mean, the desire to rule the world of greater monoculture, I'd say, is a bad idea. It is driven by delusion. I can't really see any way that that could go well. But it isn't inherently sinister. It can be wrong-headed and foolish.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
But it could just be naive.
There's that too. I guess I'm suspicious of things that want to influence me and not let me know that they're influencing me. That's an immediate red flag for me.
Well, that's central to the Fabian, but to some of the Fabian's writings and the principles that they seem to be applying, Bertrand Russell, George Bernard Shaw, H.G. Wells, this elitist view that most people are not capable of autonomy or self-awareness. Therefore, it would be futile to try and raise everybody up to the same level and have some kind of equality, real equality. So then there's this surrogate equality, which is social equality for the masses under the ruling elite. So it's a total lack of equality. It's a binary system, but it creates this homogenized culture in which equality is enforced at a social level. And I say enforced, imposed. But based on the principle that people can't make their own choices, they need to be given their identities, given their values, given their choices, given their options, right? Like if they farm to the supermarket and just follow the aisle and pick, you can pick your own brand, but it's still going to be one brand or the other, right? You're not farming, you're not growing your own produce. There's no self-sufficiency, there's no autonomy, there's no growing, developing self-awareness. One becomes a cog in the machine, one becomes totally dependent on it, and one size fits all. So that underlying belief, it really is central to social engineering, to cryptocracy, which is us and them, that we who have the knowledge and the power and the intellect have the responsibility to make the choices for the whole country, nation, and in the end for the whole planet and the whole of humanity, and the rest of humanity. Well, they're not able to act on this knowledge, so they shouldn't be given it. They'll misunderstand it. If they are given it, they'll think it's all a big dark conspiracy. Right? So, and I'm in a funny position now. I mean, maybe others are too, but I'm particularly because I was raised in that environment, that I'm one of the ruling. I never thought I was going to be a ruling elite because I was never political. I was anti-political, but that was kind of part of my indoctrination too. And that's the aristocracy are sort of anti or apolitical too. Because if you think about it, the ruling elite, they don't follow the rules that they create. And they don't vote. They don't belong to any particular party. They transcend party politics. So it's kind of more anarchic in their own lifestyle. I mean, even satanic. not to equate anarchy with Satanism, but in the sense of just ignoring all rules, you know, addressing all rules, that's consistent with anarchy as well as Satanism. I mean, Satanism is actually the opposite. It's inverting and perverting rules. So, and we're getting into the deep stuff now, but so I'll just back off and go back to what I was saying about, for myself, it's strange and it's problematic, because I agree, I'm sorry to say, that most people can't be autonomous. I just feel that that's true. I don't know, you know, they've been indoctrinated for so many thousands of years, or we have, that what chance did they ever have? So sure. I'm not saying that this is a biological reality. I don't know.
It's just been the bag of shit that's been passed along from generation to generation to generation, so much that it looks like a bouquet of flowers. They don't have anything to compare it to. And I think that there's a mixture of can't and won't. Though I think some people can get to that fork in the road. They just choose not to because it's too scary, or, you know, it's the idea. There's a lot of responsibility involved in self-reflection and deciding your destiny and choosing how you're going to navigate the world, you know? So I think it's a combination of both myself.
Yeah, absolutely. Having said all that I said before, and part of it would be still my conditioning. If I look at my own life, I can see there are plenty of ways in which I'm not ready for autonomy. I'm not taking responsibility. I'm still eating the bag of shit and pretending that it's Cheetos or kettle crisps. So
you just outed yourself there.
I did. So who am I to cast the stone? And I do like this about the Christian perspective. We're all made in the image of God. In the eyes of God, we are all equal, because we don't even exist as people in the eyes of God. God has no respect for persons. That's a transcendental view. And I can feel the truth of that. So I think the problem is when you restrict your perception to a sociopolitical and a scientistic one, equality becomes impossible, except this perversion that I've described, this H.G. Wells time machine kind of perversion, in which you've got the mass of Morlocks down below, and then you've got the LOE, this, you know, transcendental superstar elite, lording it over the rest of us, telling us that we're all equal, while the stark facts, you know, telegraph the opposite, creating schizophrenia and madness and despair. But collectively, we're all in it together, sink or swim together. Collectively, we don't seem ready for autonomy. I mean, the elite aren't autonomous either. That's the final argument, counter argument I'd make. They've got this false autonomy, which is satanic, to use that word again, but it's an inversion. And a perversion whereby their supposed freedom, it depends on, just as, you know, Jeffrey Epstein flying around in his jetliner, depends on the sweat and the back of mass slave workers. Right? Without the power to oppress others and raise them up, the elite don't have any freedom either. Yeah. They're just as enslaved as the masses.
Absolutely. Well, momentarily back to just the education system, which I think is pretty key in all of the social engineering business, because that's kind of where we learn what's on the menu, or what they want us to think is on the menu. What were the origins of forced schooling, and what purpose do you think that it served or that it does serve?
Well, I don't know the answer to the first one. Maybe you do. Forced schooling, when did it come in? Certainly before my time.
Sure, I don't have the timeline on that either. It seemed like, I don't know. I guess it depends on what school you're talking about. There's the school of culture. There's the school of sitting in a classroom.
Literally, I think it was fairly late, wasn't it? Actually, I mean, the last 200 or 300 years or something. If that, 200 maybe.
I mean, my parents both in their childhood, in grade school at least, both went to one-room schools for a long time, and all the grades were together, and it was very informal in a lot of ways. And before that, like my grandmother, I have no idea what her school system or experience was like. It was, certainly wasn't a system. I don't think it was such so. It wasn't something that was. I wouldn't define it as having some sort of an agenda behind it.
Well, certainly my schooling, I was aware I had an agenda behind it. And what's coming to me now, and this came up in a conversation I had yesterday as well, is that, I mean, it may be, and it is the case now, and has been for a while, that schooling really is mandated, and if you don't send your kids to school, they can be taken away from you, and you can homeschool. This is perhaps a relatively new wrinkle, I don't know. But when I was growing up, although that might have been true, I don't exactly know. I mean, presumably there had been some problems if my mother had just said, you can not go to school. It wasn't something that I ever really thought about. I just knew that if I didn't go to school, my mother would make me go to school. But I also kind of knew that my mother didn't really believe in sending me to school either, or at least it gradually, the penny gradually dropped. And my experience at school was that I just found more and more ways not to obey and not to comply. So I did less and less of the things they were telling me to do one by one. And eventually that involved not even showing up on certain days and somehow getting away with it. Like it just became a joke. Horsley's not here. He's shopping. He doesn't come on Saturdays. He doesn't come on Wednesdays because I gave up science because I was so bad at it. So little by little, I just started saying no. Can't make me. And I think my mother even started to twig. And I got all my O-levels, you know. It didn't change my grades because I was intelligent enough just to do what I had to do to actually pass exams. Not that I ever cared about them or needed them. But I think that my mother got educated, quote-unquote, by that, by observing that, because she's told me later on. She was amazed by how I was able to buck the system, and that maybe if she'd have realized sooner, she would have been less insistent that I go to school at all. I mean, that, we didn't exactly have that conversation. Anyway, the point I'm making here is that the state and the school system can only capture us and have this much power over us with the complicity of our parents, because children don't respect authority before their parents. I mean, the original authority is the parental authority. So if the parents didn't say you have to go to school and this is for your own good, then children would be much less inclined to just buckle down and go along, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that was what was motivating me. I mean,
same here.
Right.
My parents put a lot of emphasis on grades and stuff like that.
Exactly. And the pressures come from that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I would feign dropping my report card into a puddle of water on the way home or something and rub out my F and put in a C or something. I mean, it was ridiculous to what ends I went to disguise my lack of interest and lack of achievement in school. I mean, I was smart enough, but I just didn't do it. I didn't apply myself even that much. So I had to go an extra year.
Right.
Yeah.
And did your parents, what would they think about it now? Do you think that they would really care now, looking back, whether you got your grades or not?
I don't think that they would. I think that they realize now that the school system that I attended was not meant for anybody like me, and that it was really just about teaching kids to conform to some sort of a machinery than having anything to do with cultivating an individual's self or self-reflectiveness.
Yeah.
Which is asking a lot, but it's not impossible.
It's a bit of a mystery why parents send their kids to school and make them do school if they themselves didn't get much out of it. But I think maybe part of it is that there's been a sort of coagulation of the system along these Fabian lines of development and social engineering. So it's become more and more oppressive, restrictive, and soul-destroying. So parents don't realize necessarily, I think in some cases they do, and they actually think it was good for them to have their soul destroyed. So I think there is that element too, sadly. But I think maybe it's also that they don't realize that they had a good enough experience, and they don't at school 30 years earlier, and they don't realize that it's not like that anymore.
Yeah, there's more on the menu, more awareness, potential awareness in education than there was back then, for sure.
Well, I suppose there's more awareness, I'm not sure if it's what you're saying, but there's more awareness of the harm of education now than ever, isn't there? Because the homeschooling is becoming more and more a thing.
And my kids go to a Waldorf school, so that handles education in a completely different way, and I think it's... And I would be interested to hear what you have to say about Steiner and Waldorf and all of that. But it seems to be a much more intuitive way to cultivate curiosity in kids and not quash it. Like, I got so cynical about learning from school. Like, I just tuned out. It just wasn't engaging to me at all. And they come home and I can tell they're really engaged in what they're experiencing at school. But what do you have anything to say about that Steiner or Waldorf?
Very little. I mean, I've read quite a lot of Steiner, and I like Steiner in general. And I was actually going to do stuff at a Waldorf school in Guatemala, but I only visited a few times, and I don't think I ever did do anything there besides visit. So I don't have direct experience of Waldorf. I know somebody who sent their kid there. Certainly, you know, as a lesser of two evils, I can't see a Waldorf school being anything but benign compared to a state school, or even, you know, a corporate elite school, whatever they are. However, I mean, one proviso that's coming to me here is, I mean, because indoctrination is indoctrination, even when it's benign. I mean, that would be oxymoronic, perhaps, but I mean, even when, that's what I said before a bit about the medium and the message, that what ideology is behind it is secondary to what the actual institution represents, or what the methods are. I know the Steiner School has different methods as well as different content. But nonetheless, I would personally be wary about sending my kid to a Waldorf school, even because there's an ideology there as well. And, you know, as a counterpoint, and this isn't kind of an impossible thing to predict, for myself, I tend to feel that I got the best education I could have got going to my shitty, oppressive, elite building trauma genetic school, because it gave me training for the world. I got to see how bullshit makes the world go around, and how people are made to conform and believe in things they should never believe in. And I got to develop strategies for how to bluff my way through that and make it seem as though I was going along when I wasn't. So that was actually very useful training for me.
But yeah, you know, I can see that. Absolutely.
Maybe an exception that proves the rule. I certainly wouldn't have sent my kids to that school based on my experience. That would be absurd.
Right? Sure.
But it's just that it's a bit of a mystery in terms of what's actually going to benefit.
Yeah, I think it's a case-by-case basis.
Yeah.
Well, something also that I found fascinating about your book is that you talk about, it's the flyback.
There are two flies now. Oh.
The words on the street. They're just eavesdropping, really. How did dance music and dance halls become an effective element of this social engineering?
Well, I think I got to that, excuse me, I think I got to that lead through Richard Ackland, who was an associate of my grandfather, but I can't swear to it. It was a bit of a surprise anyway, however I got there. There's also this mass observation organization in the 40s that was training people to just go out and mix with the common people and take notes the whole time, just observe how the common man and woman lives, what kind of values they have, what they like, what they do, what they, you know, what appeals to them, as a way to get a finger on the pulse of the collective wrist. And this was, maybe I should say the 30s then, because this is the time leading up to World War II, I believe. And somehow as part of that, I discovered dance halls were considered, and because it was just something that was just coming into existence, even the idea of it, places, you know, for people to hang out together and not just drink and talk, but also to dance and listen to music, was seen as a useful tool for gathering intel. And so, but that also converged with the recognition, this is in Bertrand Russell, the use of music for indoctrination purposes, presumably because music invokes emotional response. So if you combine music with words, then people are going to be more receptive to the words. It's obvious. I mean, we all know, most people know, I imagine, or practice listening to songs to change their mood. And they love the music and they love the words of the songs they love. And that combination, the music stirs the emotions and the words kind of affirm some kind of belief they want to have about themselves. I used to listen to soppy love songs to cry, you know, when I felt I needed emotional release. I made these tapes with all these love songs on. And so I used them as a way, like self-therapeutic tool. But everybody does that to one degree or another, right? So yeah, the power of music, but that's just something we grew up with. It seems as though that was consciously, like, before music did become a thing of mass appeal, that was known. And that knowledge was central to why it became so popular. As in, there was a conscious agenda there. It doesn't mean, of course, that that's the only reason it happened. Just that that was part of it, seeing the part of the genesis of what, whatever we would call that, you know, pop music, basically. So the dance halls, but this was pre-pop music, obviously well before the Beatles. It was decided that because England was heading for war, in order to facilitate the draft, you know, people being willing to go off and fight the war, songs could be written that would instill people with patriotic fervor. And if those songs became popular, then obviously they would be more widely heard and they'd be more effective. So then the dance halls, and this was, I'm not sure when radio became about, but I don't remember writing anything about radio. So, I mean, obviously there was, radio existed, but in terms of mass radio, maybe this was before that even. Seems like it probably was. So the dance halls had this at least double function, which was to, as a venue to play these songs and get people to know these songs, then buy the records. I guess. Not, my history of music isn't that good, so I'm not even sure when people started buying records. And then the other purpose was this observation. So you get people together and they're all talking and you have these agents of mass observation milling around and they're taking notes, literally or figuratively, as a way to better understand how to effectively propagandize the peoples, I mean, particularly the working classes. I think maybe I answered your question. This converges with Jimmy Savile. I mean, that's we can at some point, if you want, come back to Jimmy Savile, but don't want to derail you wherever you might have been going with that.
No, not at all. It was just an element that I hadn't really thought about in those concise of terms before, but it totally makes sense. I mean, God, how many Smith songs did I listen to when I was in high school that I thought he was singing directly to me. It totally spoke to my pain. And how much do love songs inform how we look at relationships or the opposite sex or the same sex? Or, I mean, it's just so pervasive. I mean, I guess music and especially dance halls would be the thing that people would do before they gathered around the radio or gathered around the TV eventually. And then later gathered around the computer. I mean, maybe they don't gather. Maybe that's the problem. They're alone in front of the computer. But I see that as in a very effective way of pervasively influencing people without them really realizing it, you know? I found that fascinating.
Yeah, well, you just mapped an evolution there because the people on computers, they're constantly being bombarded with the customized algorithm-based information. So they're being propagandized more thoroughly than ever. And everything they say and do is being data collected. So that twin purpose to propagandize and to observe and monitor and gather data of the dance halls has now evolved into a panopticon.
More personalized to the individual as opposed to groups of people.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is a little, I mean, that serves to fragment people, which could be a wing of the whole divide and conquer, you know, we're pitted against each other.
Yeah, well, because the dance, I mean, this is the thing with dance halls, and we could talk about the 60s and all these things that are being re-examined now through conspiratorial lenses as nefarious. Clearly, even if they were, they also had positive results. So it's not so cut and dried. So yeah, people gathering together in dance halls, even if the dance halls were designed for these purposes, still that's people gathering together and joyous, there'd be joyous occasions. So probably, I mean, if we're going to stay with the recognition of a nefarious element, another, and I'm just speculating, but another consideration was, well, we also have to undermine that because we don't want to be building community here, because the people who have community they're not going to go to war either. They're not going to march in lockstep to the music of the state because they'll have their own solidarity and the increased awareness that comes from community. So how to make sure that these dance halls don't increase the potential for community? Well, fill them with prostitutes and drugs, make sure, you know, give them to gangsters to run them, so make sure that essentially they're kind of toxic places from the ground up, or the basement up. This is Jimmy Savile, right? He ran these dance clubs, and he had a basement, and he took people down in the basement who transgressed and tortured them, according to his own admission anyway, which is obviously a very stark, visceral image of something, the underworld of the dance club, but also just a simple fact. And obviously, and there's huge profit in prostitution and drug running. So that's another, a third reason, possibly even a primary one, for the dance halls, that shows again an intersection between organized crime. I say again, because we haven't talked about it, but I'm always ending up there, between organized crime and intelligence agencies and popular culture, those three things converging like that.
Another thing that I found out in your book that I didn't, was something that I wasn't aware of, that's a part of the superculture again, is the Uranian movement. What was that all about?
That was about the third sex. So that's something that has taken a while to, you know, come to full flowering in our culture. The divine androgyne, not sure if the Iranian movement used that phrase, but that's certainly one I heard for many years. I mean, the Iranian movement was back in the 1800s. I don't know a great deal about it. It was just an example of one of those data points, as this really got my attention. So this is an Uranian, I mean, I'm not even confident in saying this, but I presume that Uranian is from Uranus and Uranus. I just changed the pronunciation there to avoid any eagles in the audience.
They're Uranus, both doomed.
his rules Aquarius, and the age of Aquarius is the one that we're supposedly entering into, and certainly pertains to sort of strange quirks of evolution. Autism relates to the age of Aquarius and Uranus, and the androgynous beings and aliens and so on. David Bowie's coming to mind. So that's consistent with the, the sexual liberation thing, to keep it simple, but it's more than that. I mean, the psychedelic movement as well. Seems as though there were a particular kind of esoteric ideology, which is runs through the Fabian agenda, quite secretly, occultism essentially. Is there in the Uranian thing, and it's more, I think, more overtly, because it was quite openly weird, the Uranian thing, and clearly it's, as I say, it's come to some sort of fruition with the transgender movement today, which doesn't, as far as I know, acknowledge the Uranian movement at all. I don't even know if most activists are aware of it. And the transgender movement is certainly a state-sanctioned one. It is state-dependent, certainly, at least if people are going to physically transform. I forgot there was a third thing, but the point I was getting to was it's very occult, but in the old traditional sense of the occult, it's hidden. Like most transgender activists, I don't know about transgender individuals, because there's a difference here often, generally speaking. Transgender individuals, if we're going to call them that, people who are confused about their sex and want to experiment, let's say, aren't generally ideologically driven, I would say. Well, they wouldn't be, would they? There's some inner confusion they want to resolve. But there's an ideology behind transgender, and it's not openly occultist. It's postmodernist. You could say it's atheistic, it's liberal progressive. Fabian even, I mean, Russell Brand comes to mind, not that he's transgender, but he kind of looks like it if he didn't have a beard. He's certainly consistent with that vibe. The occult elements is suppressed and hidden and concealed because it's not really compatible
exactly with
it. I kind of forgot exactly where I was going with this, but it's just another observation, I guess.
Because we're steeped in a materialist culture, I don't think the occult is ever, it's not even on most people's radar. That's some sort of antiquated notion of, I don't know, a whole subworld or dimension that exists or existed to a group of people that tried to manipulate it to their means, so on and so forth. It just seems like a bunch of blather, probably to most people, which, you know, materialism and scientism is its own religion in a sense, and which.
Thank you. I mean, that probably is the point. If anyone wants to make it's devil by any other name, it's transmuted. It's wearing different clothes, but it's essentially the same value set.
Well, which I have a question here. How do you think that modern materialism keeps many from being able to comprehend organized ritual abuse? Because it's propelled by the occult, or because... Why?
Why do people not see it? I mean, why do they not want to see it? Answers itself, doesn't it?
Because it's despicable and awful.
Yes, that's right, and it disrupts one's pleasant fantasy. The other thing, I mean, it's really central to so many conversations I have is you pull on a, it's a house of cards. If you pull on this tapestry, if you pull on this thread and just keep pulling, the whole thing comes unraveled. So the way that the organized abuse conceals itself is that it's embedded in the culture, and it's the way that it's installed itself in our culture is by shaping our values. And it's not just that the values conceal the abuse, but they also sustain and maintain it, and they're symptoms of it. If that, you know, if that maybe needs unpacking, but I'll try and at least finish the point I was going to make. Which, so then if you start to look at, it's a bit like if you look at your favorite junk food. If you look at the ingredients and then you look the ingredients up online, maybe not your or mine, because I try and avoid even natural flavor, because I'm like, well, it's a natural flavor. Tell me what it is, please. Right. But anyway, and you find out what they are, and maybe you do a bit more research and you find out the effects on your physiology. And so you're going to say, well, really, I can't eat that stuff in clean conscience. So if people look more closely at the evidence of organized abuse, I mean, one of the reasons they don't, we saw this with Pizzagate, or I did, Pizzagate in quotes, obviously that's a hashtag that has now vilified it. But anyway, with the evidence that came up that was then labeled Pizzagate, it was so closely aligned with social sets and social values and aesthetic criteria or aesthetic values that are close to what many people live by, you know, admire, respect, embrace, that the reaction was to reject it. Because and so by rejecting it meant not looking more closely. Because if it were to look more closely and just say, well, maybe these avant-garde, artistic, LGBT, gay, you know, free expression, whatever, these values, if they're concealing some sort of organized abuse, let's just look closer just to see past them. If you do that, I mean, first of all, that takes a leap to be willing to do that. But if you do that, you'll also end up looking at the values in itself. And it isn't just, it would be shocking enough for people to think that benign, what they thought of as benign values and values that they live by were concealing abuse. But to start to see that they're symptoms of abuse and facilitators of it, and really kind of inseparable, that somehow that value set is itself consistent with an abusive kind of lifestyle. You know, what I'm trying to say, you can't separate it out. So, I mean, there's another thing in here, but I don't know if I'll be able to bring it in, because this is such a large thing. I'm not sure if I can even hold it all in my mind, but because one of the things around organized abuse, and I changed it to, I changed satanic ritual abuse in my own terminology to organized ritual abuse, because the satanic element seems a bit arbitrary. Like, there's plenty of kinds of ritual abuse that aren't overtly satanic in the superficial sense. They might be satanic in a deep philosophical sense, but they are organized, and there are rituals involved of some form or another. But anyway, one of the things I looked at there is that if you associate abuse, organized abuse, with ritual, occult ritual, and particularly satanic, because people, there's a particular set of people who don't believe in Satan and don't believe in all that stuff and just think it's crazy stuff, somehow the fact that that's in there makes the whole thing just seem absurd and beyond the pale.
Yeah, exactly.
So that And that, and with what happened around Pizzagate, there was a combination there, which I think maybe, and I can bring it together, because for the kind of mindset or, you know, social set that was involved in the Pizzagate, the comment ping pong stuff, whatever was going on there, and that was defending it, which is a much larger demographic, for that set, although, of course, with the comment ping pong, who may have been complicit, it's a bit blurrier. Satanic and occult stuff's just avant-garde arty, man. It's got nothing to do with actual rituals. Not really. Even Abramovich's an avant-garde artist. That's not ritual. That's art. And certainly nothing to do with organized abuse, because that's just crazy Christians who put those two together. So it's very interesting just talking about this, because if they get prematurely conflated, it muddies the water so much that then people can just dismiss any association at all. But in fact, there's a continuum there. There's absolutely a continuum between artistic avant-garde lifestyles, sexual liberation, occult rituals, and organized abuse. It's absolutely a continuum. It just doesn't mean that everyone who's an artist is an occultist, is a Satanist, is a child abuser, right? Or the other way around, everyone who's abusing, right? Clearly it would be erroneous to mash them together. But number one, organized abuse is so prevalent that under the surface that we've all had contact with it one way or another. Number two, the culture that conceals it is so prevalent in a different way, in that we consciously and openly embrace it. These are the values of David Bowie or Aleister Crowley or the Beatles. They're good. Or Robert Mapplethorpe, if you're going to be a bit more edgy, but you know, they're supposedly good. They're about freedom of expression. So to start pulling on that and discovering that might actually be a cloak for something that's evil, that's a bridge too far for most people. So they'll end up, with no culture at all that they can believe in or turn to. I mean, they feel that they would, I suppose.
For sure. I totally agree. You brought up Crowley. Where does Crowley fit into the world of organized ritual abuse? He's somebody that, you know, almost because he's vilified, he's deified by the underdogs or the, you know, the people who call themselves magicians, or, you know, he's seen as sort of an underdog, sort of a anti-hero kind of, but there's a lot of sinister stuff going on around Crowley.
Yeah, and I was just thinking about it too, like, because, yeah, it's very hard. Well, no, again, there's two things going on. I mean, I found it very hard to place him in the context of organized abuse, ritual, and otherwise, and in this culture that we're talking about, even though he's clearly a central figure, one of half a dozen or even a quarter dozen central figures in this, in terms of influence and possibly complicity as well. And that's because there's a real wall of resistance to this idea that I've encountered. And there's a prevalent mindset out there, which is like the intelligentsia, it seems to me. And it's a particular, it seems to be class related, and I haven't figured it out. I haven't tried that hard either. That even if they're not particularly into Crowley, and even if they'll defend him, they won't defend him rather per se. And Peter Lavender claimed he wasn't defending Crowley. Still, they'll advocate, or they will endorse, or they will at the very least, what's the word? They will give him a free pass. So I'm thinking, someone like Douglas Rushkoff, who endorsed one of my books, he went all out and advocated, because he wrote a graphic novel, I haven't read it, in which Crowley was the hero in World War II, fighting magic against the Nazis.
Rushkoff?
Rushkoff, yeah.
Really?
Little known fact, yeah. Hmm. I mean, that's just one example. I'm thinking of, I mean, this guy Kaczynski, but I don't even know who he is besides Alistair Crowe's biographer, but he wrote this huge book. I mean, he's a member of Thelema. Eric Davis is a member of the Thelemic, Thelema, Order of Thelema. I mean, there's a lot of people, famous, not famous, but for your listeners, well known, Runesu, that guy, Gordon Light.
Yeah.
They might not be Crowleyites per se, or even Thelemites, which is practically the same thing, but they absolutely, at the very least, give Crowley a free pass. So who are they? I mean, what kind of set is that? It seems closer to your or my set as compared to the Quanon, if we can call them that. And weirdly, the Keck magicians, I don't know all of them or even any of them personally, but that kind of set that is really into conspiracy theory, let's say, for one thing. I mean, that's one way of summing them up. So in that sense, they're closer to you and I. What I see more and more is that they're virulently distrustful and even despise Crowley. And they're not necessarily Christians. It used to be, it was just the Christians revile Crowley, and then the artists and the intelligentsia kind of either ignore him or they think he's great. But it's not so clear now. And I mean, I've talked a lot about this now just because it's just an area of curiosity to me, having written this book. It seems to me it's impossible not to have some sort of opinion about Crowley. And I would take that further and say that it's irresponsible not to have some sort of position, although I'm a liminalist, so in a certain sense I'm against taking positions. But I think when somebody is so culturally prevalent and so culturally respected and influential, and of course we're seeing this now with cancel culture, in a bad way, I would say, possibly, or more than possibly, indisputably complicit with and responsible for all kinds of distortions and destructive agendas and beliefs and thought. I mean, Christ, isn't it time? It's running out of time here. Isn't it time just to blow the whistle on this guy?
Yeah. I always thought he was a creep.
Well, but there's lots of people who think that, and somehow I guess I'm always focusing on the people that I want to wake up, because it bothers me that that there's this divide. I wish there could be more of a dialogue, I suppose, because for many people it's just, yeah, he's a creep, it's obvious, and right? And then there's the staunch defender and the Crowleyites and the Thelemites. I mean, they're really hardcore, and they will attack. But the people I know more often, if they're not in your camp, they're just on the fence. And I think, well, how can you be on the fence about something like that?
Yeah, exactly. I was, in the 80s, I was steeped in the Temple of Psychic Youth, chaos magic, all of that stuff. And, of course, Crowley was a big deal to most of those people. I can never figure out why. And I didn't know as much as I did after I got done reading your book. And I still thought he was like, what is there to hold in esteem with this guy? I mean, so what? He figured out a magical system that seems effective, but at what cost? For God's sakes, there's lots of other ways of going about doing what he did that don't involve the things that he involved, fucking over people and children and insane amounts of drugs. And yeah, his actions to me spoke much louder than any words that he had written. But you were, you were heavy into Crowley back in the day too, weren't you?
Yeah, I'm in the privileged position in many other ways as well. Like, I've been poor and rich, and I've been homeless, and I've been super wealthy, and I've been in the middle. So with Crowley, yeah, I've been a not exactly a devout follower, but certainly an adherent of his systems and philosophies and stuff. And an open critic. And so it seems to me that there is value, and I, of course, explore this with Strieber and Prisoner Infinity, and now I hope with Hollywood, there is value in studying the moves and the methods of a maniac, particularly one who's super influential. I mean, nobody would say that you shouldn't read, well, somebody would, but I think it would be absurd to say you shouldn't read Mein Kampf, because Hitler was a nasty piece of work. I mean, I don't personally want to read it, but understanding madness, depravity, and possibly evil, has got to be a worthwhile endeavor. So what bothers me is the compartmentalization. And I think it does go on both sides. So, I mean, it was obvious with the Christians. And as you say, you know, Crowley's partly deified because he was vilified, or even largely. If he hadn't been so vilified, he wouldn't be deified now, I think. And that's, I mean, I've talked about that in another conversation, so I won't try and unpack it. It's fascinating how that works. So I do think that, it's funny because I say you can't be on the fence, but about Crowley. But one can be liminal. Like, where it's what's more interesting with Crowley than, looking at all the vices and saying what a fucking creep he was, and certainly than looking at the writings and the visionary stuff and saying, well, he really was onto something, is juxtaposing the two together and seeing how they coexisted. And this was the hardest thing about Lies of Kings, and I don't know if I was successful, and I don't even know if I want to have been successful, but I was trying to, first of all, show how depraved Crowley's behaviors may have been, how destructive, how abhorrent, enough to say, well, evil. I mean, certainly his actions, evil behaviors, how they might have been justified in his own mind in such a way that I, the writer, and thereby the reader, would have to have a question about that. As in at a physical, at visceral level, perhaps I would know, or we would know, yes, that's insanity. But at an intellectual level, because the intellect's never going to lead us through this labyrinth anyway, to doubt, well, maybe Crowley was a martyr. Maybe he was sacrificing his own soul or his own well-being in order to try and purge some evil in the human race, committing the most greatest. Because if that, in a certain sense, maybe that's the result. I mean, you know, when Jesus went on the cross, he got crucified, he took it on himself. Obviously, that's the opposite, taking out on other people. But in terms of if Crowley voluntarily damned his own soul with some idea that somehow he could redeem humanity, I'm not saying that's true, but let's just say, it's a different context to just he was a creep. I mean, it's more terrifying.
Yeah, for sure.
That kind of delusion, the depth of that delusion, and even the possibility it wasn't delusion. I mean, that's the most terrifying. How do we know?
Indeed. But children played a big part in his rituals. And I mean, they contained a special sort of energy in his system that made them, you know, very, I'm trying to think of the word. Powerful. And I didn't realize that at all. As I said earlier, as much as I thought that he was a creep and despicable, and I didn't understand why anybody would want to respect this guy, I had no idea that even with his own children, he may have been involved in some things that are pretty unspeakable.
Yeah. Yeah, so and that's maybe, you know, because I could have jumped the shark in the last thing I said, at least for some people, I imagine it was a bit like that. So maybe a way to dial it down is that looking at Crowley, as I did with Vice of Kings, to me, it was very valuable in terms of understanding why occult rituals of self-empowerment always seem to involve child abuse, how central that is to it. And so at some level, at least, and one of my criticisms of Crowley, like I said, indisputable, is that indisputable evidence that he was complicit, even separate from what he himself recorded that he did with his own children, is he didn't talk about any of this stuff. He didn't reveal it. We know it was going on now and that he was deeply embedded in that world. So there's no way, at the very least, he wouldn't have known about it. So he didn't talk about it. So why not? Well, maybe at some level he was trying to expose something, but that it was so encoded in his own life and his body, because he himself couldn't process it, that it takes, one has to dissect the corpse to find the virus. Same thing I did with Strieber. He's confessing something that he himself doesn't know he's confessing. And I hope that that's a way to redeem the subject as well, because then it has a value independent of the false value that people have assigned to it.
And again, it's a dynamic where, at least in Crowley's use of children and maybe even his own kids, where trauma gets reframed as something that's positive, where it gives you access to the divine or accelerated evolution or different dimensions, however you want to put it, and using them, children, as the fulcrum for that.
Yeah, and that's... I mean, who knows at what level that goes on? And again, the spectrum or the continuum of that, from the extremes of Stranger Things or MKUltra or The Shining or whatever, you know, fiction and real life cases we know about, and Strieber, that are so horrifying and yet so fascinating, to the most ordinary kind of parent-child relations in which children use their parents. I mean, sorry, Freudian slip there, probably the secret that conceals itself. I don't dare, you know, speak the truth. Parents who use their children as a way to access life force. You have to feel more alive. I mean, even a parent who has a child because they want to, they like to improve their lives or their status. Isn't that harvesting one's own children?
Sure, absolutely. Or, I mean, it may be trauma induction in children is a way for some to objectify or capture the innocence that they see in these children.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, to live through their children. So it's... I think it's something that's so prevalent that we can only see it by either looking at very specific experiences that we've had and people we know, which is going to be difficult, or looking at really extreme cases. And the problem with looking at extreme cases is we might think that that is what they look like all of the time, and that compared to that, you know, we don't notice the subtler, when really what those extreme cases are showing us is the nature, the fabric of our culture and our society. It's probably in the myths. I've just been thinking of Saturn and how he devoured his children, that myth. And we know about child sacrifice going back through prehistory. And that's an extreme ritualization of something. Just as the Saturn myth is you know, mythologization of something that just seems like it's purely symbolic, And I suppose in most cases it is purely symbolic. Like most parents clearly don't eat their children. I think Satanists probably do. I think there are human groups that do this still to this day. But I suppose what I'm trying to get to is, you know, what kind of world and what kind of culture and society comes out of those practices that have gone on for thousands of years. That is, I mean, I'm thinking of something my brother said once, which was that he joked, as he always joked. He said, I had an inner child once, but I aborted it. I think that's what we do. We try and kill our inner child, all of us, and we're trained and conditioned to do that, to sacrifice that to the world so that we'll gain success.
Yeah, there's lots of ways of doing that, or at least sort of suffocating it or putting a veil over it so we don't have to realize maybe how separated we've become from that innocence in ourselves, or that, you know, that person that was in us at one time that was maybe more curious or more kind or more altruistic or whatever. There's lots of different ways of that. So people do tons of drugs or pass the shit on to somebody else or get totally absorbed in their careers or whatever, you know, or compulsively watch TV all day long or CNN to keep away from the little kid that's shouting inside of them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I've just realized, and maybe you were going to say the same or something similar. I realized that I'm quite tired. We must have been going on a couple of hours. And it occurred to me just as we got on this last subject that it's been all bad today. Everything we talked about has been so dark. But we're talking about Vice of Kings. I haven't said anything about the life force and the soul and the joy of being here. And it's really the only reason I want to emphasize. Oops, you froze up.
Yeah, so did you. You're still frozen, but I can hear your words, so.
Same, yeah. Oh, well. Whatever that signifies.
Yes.
Still got the voices. Oh, there you go. You're back.
Yes.
To excavate the treasure that we had to burrow through a lot of shit to get to the treasure, and that I was glad that we'd ended on something that was closer to what's really worth getting to, which is that, you know, we're sifting through all this bathwater really to get back to the baby and rescue the baby of our true nature, of our essential nature, which has been, buried under all this crap, ancestral generation crap, hundreds or thousands of years of it. I was just noticing you have black walls. That's a bit sinister.
It looks black, but it's really dark blue.
Okay.
Well, I think it's good that you mentioned that, because I think that without really reflecting on it, I think that I assumed that our listeners would assign that purpose to this conversation, that we're indeed trying to parse all of this out and unpack it in order to get to, as you said, the treasure. So I'm glad that you came out and said that, because that, yeah, I probably should have stated that, or it should have been brought up more during the interview, but perhaps at the end of the next part of this ongoing conversation for your most recent book, we can sum all of it up and come up with some master jewel that we can present the listeners, and they will indeed see a reason for all of this. But it's different when you read the book. That is apparent. But yes, in this conversation, I have focused on more of the darker things. So thank you for bringing that up.
Yeah, you're welcome. I wouldn't have become aware if I hadn't noticed how tired I'd become, and I thought, why is that? Oh, it's because we've been focusing on this stuff. But fair enough. I did write 16 Maps of Hell as my attempt to actually get to the exit and the light. So it makes sense we would save it for the next one, if God willing, that is. Vice of Kings is pretty unremitting in its darkness. And I'm glad to say that it's behind me now. It's probably the hardest book I ever had to write. Because who wants to live inside Aleister Crowley's psyche for however many months? It's a dirty job, but somebody had to do it. And I just hope that old Aleister, wherever he is, appreciates it.
Yeah. And if there is reincarnation, what the hell did he come back as?
He came back as my cat, Galbanzo. That's in the book.
Oh, yeah, of course. I forgot about that. It's a good point. Okay, well, we'll sum this up. Thank you so much again for having this conversation. I look forward very much to reading the next book. Excuse me. If you just want to tell people where they can find you and your stuff online, your podcast, and where they can order your books.
It's all at one site. So horticulture.com, and the Limitless podcast between is the weekly. And if anyone would like to contact me directly, that's Jason with a U at protonmail.com. I've got a regular weekly men's group going on, which is really a satisfying experiment project. And the Limitless podcast is open to listeners as well if they want to have a public conversation with me.
Cool. Fantastic. Yeah, I highly recommend it. It's a fantastic podcast. And of course, we wouldn't be here if I didn't enjoy your books. So thank you, my friend, and go eat and rest, whatever that entails. And I will do the same.
And yeah.
We'll talk probably maybe at the beginning of the new year, if you're up for it.
Wherever I may be by then, but yes.
Okay. Hopefully.
There's my cat. He's hungry too. So.
Okay. Well, have a good night, Jason, and we'll talk soon. We'll figure out a time to talk next.
Okay. Thanks, all right. Chris.
Yeah, take care. Bye. Wow. Congratulations for getting through all of that, listeners. And I don't mean that because it was boring or anything like that. Droll. Whatever. No, it's very engaging stuff, and some of it goes very deep, and some of it is very dark. But I'm glad that Jason brought up there towards the end that, you know, it's good to talk about the other side of this, too. It's good to talk about getting past all of this and getting above all of this, and realizing that there is actually something to be done with all of this information. And I have a feeling that we will be getting more into that during our next and last conversation having to do with this series of books on social engineering. Again, Vice of Kings, excellent book. I highly recommend it. I think it's the best book, my favorite book by him that I've read so far. And I have a feeling that the next one, 16 Maps to Hell, is going to be even more so. I just received my copy in the mail, and it looks incredible. It looks fantastic. I also got an audiobook version of it too, and that sounds very, very interesting too. I probably will get to that first because I just have more time to listen than I do to read, sadly enough, because I have a job that I have to attend to and bring in money, as my podcast doesn't do that heavy lifting yet. But I intend for that to be the future of this podcast and the future of my relation to it. If you like what you've heard during this episode and you'd like to hear more, and by more I mean not just continuing episodes, but more episodes, a more abundance of episodes, a way to make that happen is, in a very tangible way, contributing financially. You can do that. The easiest way of doing that would be going to www.patreon.com/themeltpodcast, and there you will find out how to contribute for as little as a dollar a month. I don't have a whole lot of premiums right now, but I intend on that changing. I just am in the middle of sort of redoing the aesthetic of the podcast and of the logo and such. And with that will be something that will be a much easier and much more aesthetically pleasing to put on t-shirts and stickers and such. And those will also be included in future premiums too, along with perhaps mini documentaries or video versions, which I already have, of some of the interviews that I do. So there's all of that. But for a dollar, I would like to think that one doesn't necessarily need some sort of incentivizing to do that, because it's not much of a commitment. But it does help a hell of a lot. If several of you contributed a dollar a month, that would indeed go a long ways. And I want to pay these podcast bills. I have to pay for the program that I use to make the artwork for it. I would eventually like to pay the people that are so kind to give their generosity to help out with different aspects of this podcast. And I would like to upgrade equipment, so on and so forth. And again, make it more of a job. I would love to devote more time to this and be cranking out at least a podcast a week, if not more, and have time to do all the research that it takes to be a well-informed host of said podcast. So it's not just, a one-way conversation. I think it's more engaging when the person doing the interviewing knows a bit about what is being talked about. So I try to do that as best I can, but I would love to be able to devote more time to that. Another way of contributing would be to share the episodes or the podcast itself, all the links involved in all of that, on your social media platform of choice. Or another way of contributing would be going to Apple Podcasts, Google Play, wherever it is that you get this podcast, Stitcher, so on and so forth, and leaving a good review. That goes a long way. And giving it a good rating, that kind of puts us up the ladder a bit, so that when people go searching for podcasts such as this, will be a lot more easy to find. I am getting slowly, very, very slowly, but surely getting together a Discord server so that you and I and all of us and some of the guests that I have on here too can get together and chat about the subjects that we talk about here and more. So I am very much looking forward to that. And as I said, the slowly but surely, the aesthetic of the Melt is changing to something that I find much more pleasing and is much more indicative of, I think, the mood and the vibe of the podcast. So, again, I also ask you to contribute. It's not as much as I would like, but every so often I am able to put a story that a listener records of their firsthand experience with some of the stuff that we talk about here on the Melt. And I will put it potentially at the beginning of a future episode that has to do with the subject matter of what you might be talking about in this hypothetical recording that you're going to send me. If you have such a thing and you would like to send it to me, you can send that to themeltpodcast@protonmail.com. And I believe that is all the news so far. I am getting Patreon subscribers, and I really, really, really appreciate it. It really makes me feel good to know not only that people are listening, but that they care enough to contribute. And as I said, it helps this to grow and expand and only improve, and hopefully, you know, affect the abundance of the content too. So I want to keep it coming, and I want to keep the quality as high as I can. So I thank all of you so much for listening. It's very much appreciated. I have so many good episodes in line in the queue. And yeah, it's just very exciting. Wonderful conversations that I'm having with people that I find highly interesting about subject matter that I think is really important. And, you know, often something that you can actually use, not just some fluff, but often there will be episodes about things that, you know, you can utilize to help improve your life or to help maybe improve how you interact with the world, and put forth that in order to make the world a better place by embodying that change in yourself. So hopefully I'm doing some of that. Anyway, thank you all so much for listening. Please keep up listening. And don't forget to subscribe wherever you subscribe to podcasts. And I will see you in 2 weeks. Thank you so much. Take care.